We started out long ago here, then. And it seems to have taken.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to work out, probably.
And we practiced together at Tassajara Monastery in California for some years.
Yeah, a few years.
And welcome home.
Thank you. Thank
you for having me. You might say a word about what you're doing now in a few minutes.
Sure.
Okay, sure.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's lovely to be back here at Austin Zen Center at home. And as Kosho said, I started out here some years ago. In fact, tomorrow is my anniversary of my ordination here. And it's the first one we did at Austin Zen Center. And it happened right in this room here. And Kosho came from Tassajara. And help me. I have pictures of you helping me with my robe on.
Yes. Remember, I put it on upside down.
That was the robe incident. Yeah, it was actually not your fault. It was sewn wrong. In some ways, we had put the ties on upside down or reversed or something, and so we couldn't figure out how to put it on.
It was really difficult.
So, but it worked out, and here we are. So, maybe I could tell you a little bit about what I'm doing in Northwest Arkansas. I have a small practice place there, and it's in the Ozark Mountains. And the intention is to have this as a place just to really focus on sitting. The lineage that I'm ordained in now really focuses just on Zazen, not much ceremony, just a lot of sitting. And so we do this particular style of Sesshin, and the idea is to do one every month there. And I do a monastic schedule. I sit quite a bit of Zazen, about 5 periods of Zazen a day, and then do work and have a study period similar to the way it is at Tassajara. So I'm doing a monastic schedule there. And all of you are welcome to come. So please please come. We could probably talk about it first before you showed up, but you can get my contact information if you're interested. But we have a website and stuff that a dear friend of mine has set up. So you can check it out if you'd like. Okay, for the talk today, I would like to talk about the study of the self. And this is the foundational practice of Buddhism. Basically, it's the whole point. So what is the point, though? What is this really about when we say studying the self? It really addresses everything that we encounter in life. We can't encounter anything but the self, actually. It's about our entire experience of living, of life and death. It addresses questions such as, who am I? What is the nature of my suffering, of my well-being? What is my place in this world? What is my relationship to the things that I encounter? To the other people, things that I encounter. And ultimately, how do I live a life with meaning and energy put into that study? And what do I do in this moment is really the real question. What do I do right now, right here? And I think a misunderstanding of the nature of self is not too much of a generalization, I think, to say that it causes most all of the suffering that we encounter in this life. Aggression, violence, exploitation, depression, despair, prejudice, war, intolerance, poverty. Those things, I think, well, crime, war, are all a result of a misunderstanding of the nature of self. And in Buddhism, it's a little bit confusing because we hear things that sound contradictory, actually. We hear teachings like this from the Dhammapada. The Shakyamuni Buddha says, evil is done by oneself. By oneself is one purified. Evil is left undone by oneself. By oneself is one cleansed. Purity and impurity are one's own doing. No one purifies another. No one purifies one. No one else purifies one. And here, you know, purity and impurity are basically suffering, the causes of suffering and the relief of suffering. But in other places, we can read things like this from the Pali Canon also. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One and said to him, Venerable Sir, it is said, empty is the world, empty is the world. In what way, Venerable Sir, is it said, empty is the world? It is, Ananda, because it is empty of self and of what belongs to self that it is said, empty is the world. So it sounds a little like he's contradicting himself here. But hopefully we'll explore that a little bit as the talk goes on. But of course, this is a huge subject. All of the Buddhist canon, basically, has been written about this. And I'm going to talk about a very tiny piece of it from my perspective here this morning. And specifically, I'm going to talk about it in terms of tractors and squirrels. This is the Dharma of tractors and squirrels. So, the tractor dharma is, you know, I've been thinking and dreaming about this practice place for some years and thinking of a way, you know, to fulfill my vow to have this practice place and doing a lot of work on it, and then encountering some very helpful and generous people to help me accomplish part of this task. And found some property, and we bought the property, and I was actually in love with it. You know, it was perfect, I thought, in every way. You know, well, you know, that's a little bit, you know how it is when you first fall in love. It's it seems that way. But, of course, reality sets in, you know, after a while, and we have to practice with what's actually in front of us rather than our idea of the way we want it to be. So one of the things that I wanted to have in place for this practice place was that it be very quiet, and it would be in a very beautiful setting. And it is actually quite beautiful, and it is a quiet setting. But and I asked the former owners about how the noise was, and they said it was very quiet. And so then I moved to the place at the end of 2011, and you know, lo and behold, I start hearing this tractor all the time. It sounds like it's in my front yard, you know, plowing up the daisies or whatever. It's the only neighbor we really have who you can't really see from a place uses a tractor in his work. And I think something may have changed, and they're actually using it more in the front part of the property. They have another part behind the mountain where I can't hear it, but they're doing more work in the front of the property. And so a really strong reaction came up after a while when I realized that this was not just a temporary thing, and this was something I was going to have to deal with. And so all of the things coming up about, you made a bad decision, you know, you're no good, that, you know, that came up, or this is horrible, you know, this is a bad, really bad situation. I can't get out of it. What am I going to do? Everything's ruined. My dream is ruined. And hopefully I didn't entertain those thoughts, you know, too long, but they definitely come up. And the bottom line is that a strong reaction actually still comes up every time I hear that tractor. So that's one piece about the tractor. The squirrel is a little less intense. But he still, you know, he still has his edge. There's a squirrel that lives nearby, very nearby the deck of the property. And when I'm in studying, he comes at this particular time, and he goes underneath the deck and starts gnawing on stuff. And I thought it was, oh, well, that's interesting. You know, it's kind of cute, and you can hear it actually under there, this gnawing sound. I didn't know what it was for a while until I went out and looked and saw him there. And I'd actually seen him before on the top of the deck, kind of moving around, running around, and I wondered, you know, what he was doing there. And then sometime, I think after I was gone for a week or something on a trip, I came back and found these big strips of wood missing from the railing and from the... actually, there's two very nice natural cedar pillars that are holding up a awning kind of thing. And he's taking big chunks out of those. So, you know, that's another thing. So a really strong reaction comes up. I don't have any particular aversion to squirrels usually. You know, I think they're fine and kind of cute little rodents. But this, so I'll be in there studying at a certain time, and then I'll hear there's no. I hear him starting to do his work out there. And a reaction comes up, you know, because I'm settled in to my studying. I actually am doing this in my loft. I have to climb up and back down. So I have to get down and go out and shoo away the squirrel. And actually my, I call him the canine mendicant. He showed up about a year ago at the property, and you know, I took him in. We go out there and shoo away the squirrel, and he's, you know, he feels like that's part of his job, and he really enjoys that. So, you know, the squirrel is providing him with some work, so I never thought of that, actually, but there's a bright side to it. But this happens, you know, over and over again. So here is the arising of self. You know, it's actually happening all the time. But these are particular times when we can really feel the self arising and the clinging to the self and the clinging of the opinions of the self and the judgments about what's going on in our world, that this is right, that's wrong, I'm right and that's wrong, and or I really want this is another version of it, I really have to have this, and, or nothing. You know, I don't do anything is another reaction when something needs to be done. That's another thing that can happen when the self arises. The Shakyamuni Buddha taught a lot about the self, of course. And one of the things he taught, the ways that he described it, was that he said that basically the self is a series of responses. There's an object like a tractor that makes a sound, and then that sound meets my ear, and there's some kind of consciousness that arises in the mind, and we call that self. I mean, that's our experience of everything, actually. So the six senses, he said, the five senses plus the mind, he included the mind as one of the sense receptors. Receives its own thoughts too as a stimulation. So it's just a contact. There's an object and then some kind of stimulation and a reaction, and it's all cause and effect. And that's basically the self, you know. That's one way to describe it. But you can actually apply that to anything when you really start thinking about it and kind of analyzing it from that perspective. That's one way to talk about the self, one perspective. So I wanted to read a sermon that he gave about this arising of the self in terms of subject and object and contact. And it's a very famous sermon. And he's just sat down and gotten comfortable before his monks, and he starts giving a sermon. He says, "Monks, all is burning. And what, monks, is the all that is burning? The eye is burning." I have a little trouble seeing this, sorry. I need reading glasses, obviously. Thank you. The eye is burning. Forms are burning. Eye consciousness is burning. Eye contact is burning. And whatever feeling arises with eye contact, all conditions, whether pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, that is burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of lust, with the fire of hatred, with the fire of delusion. Burning with birth, aging, and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair, I say. The ear is burning, the mind is burning. And he goes through the different sense organs and says that they're burning in the same way. Seeing thus, monks, the instructed noble disciple becomes disenchanted with the eye and forms, with eye consciousness, with eye contact, with whatever feeling arises with eye contact as condition, whether pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful. He becomes disenchanted with the ear, with the mind, so forth. Becoming disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, his mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes to the knowledge it is liberated. He understands destroyed is birth. The spiritual life has been lived. What has had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. So, the Buddha is saying that all of those reactions are burning with greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, all of our problems are located right there in that reaction of subject, object, contact, clinging, you know, to contact. So, an important thing, though, that this teaching is telling us is that we're experiencing our reaction rather than the thing in itself. We're not experiencing truth. We're experiencing burning, greed, hate, and delusion. All of my life conditions, in fact, is another thing that he taught, including how I was raised, my genetic makeup, how much sleep I had last night, what I had for breakfast. All of these things go into producing that reaction to the tractor or to whatever it is that you're having the aversion or the attraction to. But the reflexive tendency is just to grab it and say, that's truth, that's the way it is. This is real, this is good, this is bad. So that is the self arising. We're imputing the self on our reaction, we're imputing the self on the stimulation too, and actually that the Heart Sutra that we chanted this morning goes further, saying even that those stimulations are empty too. Those are all just causes and conditions. All of it together is empty of self. Empty of a fixed, unchanging self. So let me read another expression from a very important Zen master about this subject, object, and the arising of self. And this is from Ehe Dogen. who is a very important Zen master in the Soto school. And this is from his Shobogenzo Makahanya Haramitsu, which is a sort of commentary on the Heart Sutra. And he says, the 12 sense fields are 12 instances of Prajnaparamita. Also, there are 18 instances of Prajnaparamita. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, form, sound, smell, taste, touch, object of mind, as well as the consciousness of eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. So Dogen Zenji is saying it's what seems like exactly the opposite thing that the Buddha is saying. He's saying that these things that arise are perfect wisdom. That's what Prajnaparamita means. Complete, perfect wisdom. But actually, I think that we're just getting two different ways of expressing something, a very important teaching, that they're being expressed in different ways from different perspectives here. So, how do we get, though, from burning greed, hate, and delusion to Prajnaparamita arising, you know, in this subject-object contact that comes up in the self arising? How does this happen? How do we get there? How can it be? Well, in the case of the tractor, for me, you know, what can I do? You can think about things that I can do. I could just go on feeling bad every time I hear the tractor and probably drive myself nuts. I could move away, give up my vow, say forget it. It's not really realistic to go to another practice place. It's just not really realistic. I could somehow try to sabotage the tractor, I guess, you know. And I could go over to the man and say, stop that tractor. Don't make food. Don't make your living, you know. It's noisy for me. But so after a little bit of study, of course, it became apparent that the only thing that could change was in here, in me. And this is the way life is often. But I brought up the case of the squirrel, too, because it's not so cut and dried, because there is something I can do about the squirrel. And, you know, it makes a big difference of how we approach things. If we approach things with greed, hate, and delusion, we're likely to do something we might regret or something not so skillful or kind. You know, but when this arising of self comes up, it's like it's a kind of insanity, you know, almost. It can be just, you know, we kind of go nuts for a while if you cling to it. So part of the challenge is, of course, is seeing the difference between these situations where there's actually a stimulation and something needs to be done, and a stimulation where, well, we just have to accept this and go on with our life and do what we can to practice within ourselves, you know, and change. And we need to do both, you know, of course, usually. But sometimes it's a little more cut and dried. So how can we make this kind of discernment? And how can we let this wisdom of Prajnaparamita arise? How do we become disenchanted, as the Buddha said, by ourselves and by the stimulation that we receive? So there must be some way in the moment of the self arising to practice with the self, or maybe even a little bit afterwards, you know. If you can catch it anywhere, it's good. You know, you're doing good. So even if it's a little bit afterwards. But sometimes we can even catch it as it arises with some practice. But to talk about this a little bit more, then I'd like to read another famous piece from Dogen's Genjo Koan. And that piece says, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be verified by all things. To be verified by all things is to let the body and mind of the self and the body and mind of others drop off. So this can be interpreted in many different ways, and it has been. But one way that I'd like to offer is this. I'll just take these sentences and comment on them a little bit. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. So maybe this coincides with evil is done by oneself. Suffering is done by yourself, and the alleviation of suffering or practice is done by ourselves. So none of you can sit my zazen, or none of you can, practice with the feelings that come up around that tractor for me. I have to accept that as self and practice with it. And one of the things, we do is say, well, there's no self, and we say that tractor is making me feel bad. And in a way, we're sort of saying there's no self in this nihilistic way and saying I'm not responsible. But we're still imputing, self on the tractor, saying that's real and it's wrong, but I'm just a victim. But Dogen here is saying, no, we have to take responsibility. This is what the Buddha said too. To study the self is to forget the self. So this is letting go of the self that arises, I think. Letting go of the burning greed, hate, and delusion. How do we become disenchanted? For me, and I think for Dogen Zenji, this is our zazen. This is what we do in zazen, is let go of everything, including the self. So we're just sitting in our zazen, and thoughts are coming up, emotions are coming up, pain might be coming up, and we let it all go. And we don't cling to it, and we don't say it's self, and we don't say it's non-self, and we don't push it away. And this is exactly, sort of the end of suffering, is none of this or none of this, but just let it be. And then all of these experiences transform because they're empty too. They go their own way. Eventually, no thought lasts forever, no emotion lasts forever. And I think this is forgetting the self. It comes up and we let go of it. Kosho Uchamaroshi had a word he coined for this. He called it opening the hand of thought. And so, thoughts come up or emotions come up, and we usually grasp them like this. But when we open the hand in zazen, they fall away. And this is also dropping off body and mind, dropping off the boundary between self and other, subject and object, self, non-self, Buddha's enlightenment. All of those dichotomies that are the source of suffering, we drop off. So I think that is forgetting the self. To forget the self is to be verified by all things. So this word verify is my teacher's translation of the Buddhist term sho. And sho is one of the Japanese words that's often just translated as enlightenment. But it actually has, a more specific meaning than that. It carries the sense of clear knowing from experience, or clear verification because of direct experience. Proof. So Dogen Zenji's great teaching is that the practice itself is verification. The enlightenment itself is the expression of prajnaparamita through zazen, or through practice, or through practicing with self, other, and subject, object, so forth. But that itself is the enlightenment or verification. So in this case, that is how everything becomes prajnaparamita. The everything we experience becomes our teacher if we don't cling and we don't push away. And that's verifying the self that is different than the usual small little, you know, self that we connect with. This is a different perspective of self that goes beyond self and non-self, actually. Okay. So when we're able to do that, there is the possibility for discernment without judgment. You know, usually just a reaction based on just you know, greed, hate, and delusion, or mindlessness is not so skillful, and it turns out to be not so wise. But when we let go of our judgment of whether something is good or bad intrinsically, and just see what needs to be done by letting go when the judgments come up, which they inevitably do, we have the opportunity for prajnaparamita to express itself as a practice. And we might have more insight about what to do. But if we're trapped in our own little box of self in black and white, this has to be done, this must stop, or, you know, this must happen, or else all is lost. We don't have any room for the wisdom. So this, I think, is our zazen informing our life. When we do the zazen on the cushion, but zazen pervades our everyday life and the decisions we make in this way, because we sort of have the faith to let go. You know, with study and zazen, we start seeing this non-self of things, the interconnection of things, and we start understanding that it's okay to let go and, you know, not go down our own habit patterns that we always have done all of our lives and cause suffering for ourselves and for others. So, you know, we get better at this, I think, with practice, hopefully. But in any particular moment, we have the opportunity to completely express truth, you know, by letting go. And we say from the other perspective, we get a little better as time goes on. You know, we hopefully catch ourselves before we react too quickly to certain situations. But then from the other perspective is that as soon as we let go, and there's an opening in our argument with our spouse, for example, and we can see that maybe I'm wrong, you know, that is the expression of truth completely, that's made possible by all things coming forward, as Dogen Zenji says, because we allow the truth of the situation to express itself. Okay, so I think that's about it. One thing I might say too, just a note about zazen and this idea of no gaining. And it's tricky when we talk about things like this, because it sounds like we start talking about doing zazen in order to deal with tractors. And that that's not the case, of course. And the reason is that we have to let go of that kind of thinking, is that there is subtle clinging to self there, of course. We can't completely let go and let the truth come forward if we think that we're doing it for something good, because our judgment of something good is part of the self. So we have to just let go of everything in zazen. And so we don't do zazen in order to become a better person. because our idea of what a better person is just a product of the self. But, you know, through letting go, good stuff does happen. That's the other perspective. We do have more clarity. I think that's all I have to say. It's 11:10. Is that time to stop?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, that worked out then. Okay, thank you very much.